WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today is World AIDS Day. Here in the U.S., new drugs have helped many people with AIDS to continue on with their lives. But these drugs are too expensive for the most hard-hit part of the world, Southern Africa. The statistics there are horrifying. In several African countries, nearly one in four adults has AIDS. This year in sub-Saharan Africa, 2 million people died of AIDS. Over half of the people who were infected there this year live in South Africa. My guest, Dr. Hussein Kouvadia, treats South African children with AIDS. He's the head of pediatrics at the University of Natal Medical School. He's also the chair of the next International AIDS Conference, which will be held in South Africa in the year 2000. 40% of the children in Dr. Kouvadia's hospital have HIV. Almost all of them got it from their mothers during labor or through breastfeeding. I asked Dr. Kouvadia to describe his hospital.
It's an old apartheid structure, which meant it was meant for Africans mostly and people who are not white. Nowadays, it's nearly always Africans who attend, so therefore it is not a well-endowed hospital, but it's one of the largest hospitals on the continent. It used to be more than 1,500 beds, so it's a huge hospital. It's a so-called teaching hospital, so-called. It's meant to be a hospital which trains doctors and nurses and postgraduates. So that's why we call it a teaching hospital. But apartheid ensured that the resources went to hospitals which were often treating white patients. So many hospitals in Johannesburg, Cape Town, Bloemfontein, etc., which were previously for the exclusive use of whites, were much better endowed. This is a dreadful place, but we do our best.
What kind of treatment can you give the babies and the children who have AIDS?
I think we give them what is available to children who are not HIV infected. That's in a nutshell, that's what transpires, I guess, in most developing countries. In most of the African countries I've been to, it's similar to what happens here. That is, the diseases they have are common diseases. They have diarrhea, which is common in HIV uninfected children. They have pneumonias, which are common in uninfected children, and so on and so forth. So they simply slot in to the routine treatment of children, and that's what we do for them. I think that there's much more we can do, but at the moment, the resources haven't been provided, certainly to us, to guarantee or to promote the additional treatment that children with HIV require.
If you had more money and more resources, what would you be able to do for the children?
Oh, I think we'd make their lives infinitely better. There are things that we could do that are being done in the U.S., for example. And when I see the results of that, the lives of children in the U.S. are far, far better catered for than the children we see over here. For example, the use of antiretroviral drugs in children is proven to have multiple benefits. It's not just the attack on the HIV virus, which it does efficiently, which these drugs do efficiently. So you reduce the load of the virus in the baby, and therefore you make the baby better. But the child recovers from other diseases more rapidly. The child grows better. The child feels better. And so these innumerable benefits accumulate just from antiretroviral therapy, which is not available to us. It's not available to nearly all the countries in Africa that I've been to. So that's simply at the level of the provision of antiretrovirals. But there are other things we could do. There could be better care in the homes, which is cost-efficient, which means it's often affordable in developing countries. Care for children at home, more follow-up by some type of health worker. Doesn't have to be a health professional, a health worker, in their homes to make their lives a bit easier, to cater for the repeated infections, for the failure to grow, the 1,001 other problems they have. So that sort of community outreach program is simply not available, even in South Africa, which is not as poor as most of the countries in Africa. It's a relatively resource-rich country. It's a middle-income country, if you wish, more on the scale of places like Brazil and Thailand and so on. So we don't have that outreach program either. We don't have the sort of clinic support, by which I mean a dedicated group of doctors, a specifically identified group of nurses, social workers, occupational therapists. You name the whole range of problems, because these kids have almost every organ involved. You need a wide range of disciplines to cater for them. If I had that, if I had a unit which looked after these children, I could provide much, much better care. But we simply don't have it. And I can understand the government's difficulties when it has to decide on priorities. Do you decide on priorities which deviate or divert funds from children who are uninfected towards children who are infected? It's a difficult decision to make.
Is there a split in South Africa between the haves and have-nots and the kind of health care that they receive if they have AIDS? And, you know, is there a split between the typical, say, white middle-class person's access to AIDS drugs and the typical black person's access to AIDS drugs now?
No question about it. The problems of apartheid are going to take a long, long time. And one of those effects of apartheid which persist to today are the access to resources. There's no question that the privileged, who are mostly, but I must insist that it's not entirely, mostly white, still continue to today, and it's going to continue for a long time. And that's a reality across the board. So whether it's access to justice or education or housing or income or whatever, those disparities still persist, and they will persist for a long time, and it therefore manifests itself in inequalities to access to healthcare for AIDS too. However, there is a difference that HIV/AIDS is not a major problem in the white population. Nor, in fact, we have a large number of people of Indian origin here too. It's not a major problem in those populations. It's really an overwhelming problem in black African, South Africans, if that's the right term, but that's the group. So the children who are affected are nearly all African children. And they, as I've indicated, get very little in terms of care.
What do you think in South Africa HIV has particularly struck the black population and the white population much less so?
I think it's a effect of the way the disease spreads. So if you wish, in medical terms, it's the epidemiological pattern of the disease. It's the social basis of the disease, and probably it's the economic basis of the disease. But I don't believe, and I don't think many people who deal with the disease believe, that it's simply a question of poverty. It's not that. It's not that. AIDS makes the life of poor people infinitely worse. It makes it much worse. So it flourishes amongst the poor. And the poor people have less access to healthcare, so they suffer more and they get more of the problems of HIV/AIDS. They have less access to health resources, so they don't get treatment. They may have less education, so they don't have the incentives to use preventive measures. So poverty exacerbates AIDS. However, AIDS doesn't depend on poverty alone, because well-off people also get HIV/AIDS. And if you look at Africa, the example is starkly clear. One of the better-off countries in Africa is Botswana, compared to much of the rest of Africa. The rest of Africa is far worse economically. And yet the prevalence of HIV/AIDS is highest in Botswana compared to most of the other countries in Africa, which are far poorer. And that applies also within countries. So it's not simply a question of poverty.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Hussein Kuvadia, and he's the chairman of the next World AIDS Conference in the year 2000, and he's the head of pediatrics and child health at the University of Natal Medical School in Durban, South Africa. How have you seen the number of AIDS victims grow in the years that you've been at this hospital in Durban?
Exponentially. When it started, the epidemic in South Africa was first amongst white men who had sex with men. So it was a smaller epidemic. And around the late 80s, must have been about 1988-89, we began to see the first cases of HIV-infected children. So that was obviously the first expression of the AIDS epidemic in the heterosexual population, which is the major form of the disease in this country. And we've seen a rise which is absolutely striking. I mean, it is so steep from virtually zero in, let's say, 1988. No cases, no experience. I didn't even know what a case looked like of HIV. I didn't know what a child with HIV/AIDS might look like from 88 till now, where roughly about 40% of our wards are filled with patients who've got HIV/AIDS. And it's not just pediatrics, it also applies to the adults. We've been following up pregnant women in our hospital and have seen a similar startling increase of HIV amongst pregnant women. And those pregnant women are also almost exclusively African. That's black African. And from a percentage, you must have been under 1% in about 88, 89, about 27 to 30% of pregnant women in our antenatal clinics are now HIV infected. That's a phenomenal number. Really almost translates to about 1 in 3 pregnant women who come to our hospital have got HIV. So it's sweeping through our wards as it's sweeping through the wards in Zimbabwe, in Zambia, in Malawi, in Kenya, in Uganda, and virtually any other country in Africa which has got a high prevalence of HIV in the adult population.
My guest is Dr. Hussein Kuvadia, head of pediatrics at the University of Natal Medical School in South Africa. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Dr. Hussein Kuvadia, head of pediatrics at the University of Natal Medical School in South Africa and chair of the next International AIDS Conference. What have you had to do at the hospital to prevent the spread of AIDS within the hospital?
I don't think the disease really spreads within the hospital. I don't think that happens. I think the hospital is really the source of provision of care. And as I've indicated, that care, I think, is inadequate because of lack of funds. But you may well ask, what are we doing about the reduction of the load or the burden of the disease? And that's where we've been trying our best to get to an answer which is appropriate not only for our country, but for Southern Africa and hopefully for the continent and maybe even relevant to all developing countries. So we've obviously been very impressed with the superb results of the American and French studies, which can prevent HIV in children by treating the mother with an antiretroviral, AZT. So that experience really was, it was a signal event. And it meant that we had to now look at the possibilities, because for the first time we now had the possibility of preventing AIDS, almost better than a vaccine, because if you prevent it in a baby, you prevent it altogether. And we are, I guess, on the brink of determining the right sort of policies which apply to our country. So ever since that trial in the States and in France, which is known as ACTG-076, many groups throughout the world, including ours, working independently, working with UNAIDS, working with CDC, working with numerous agencies, have been addressing the question of what's the best regimen of antiretrovirals to produce a similar effect in developing countries. Similar effect because we don't think ACTG 076 can easily be applied for a number of reasons to Africa and other developing countries. So we really have to find our own appropriate intervention, antiretroviral intervention.
Why don't you think it would work in South Africa?
There's been a long debate about that. And to cut a long story short, there are a number of reasons. One set of reasons is logistical. That is, the way the study was designed in the U.S. and France, it depended on having good antenatal clinic services. It depended on having early attendance at antenatal clinic. It depended on having facilities at these clinics for giving intravenous injections. So there were these logistic reasons which made it impossible to translate that into poor countries, especially developing countries in Africa. The second reason is that the population had different risk factors. For example, in the States and in France, you could discontinue breastfeeding and therefore remove a major source of transmission without causing too much of harm to the babies. Now, you can't do that in Africa or Asia or some other poor countries. Breast milk is a really important food. It's a nutrient. In fact, it's the only nutrient which may be available to thousands and thousands of women in Africa. They either cannot afford to buy another type of milk, like a formula, or they may be unwilling to change because breast milk is not just an ordinary contact of between mother and child. It's deeper. It's got huge cultural connotations, and it's been there traditionally for ages. And as I said earlier, some women just won't have a choice. I mean, formula feeding is not cheap. It costs a lot of money. And people in Malawi and parts of South Africa and Zambia and Uganda simply would not be able to afford that. So it was important to look at the role of breastfeeding and how we can address it. And I must say, we haven't succeeded yet. We have a rough idea of what we might be able to do. And we might be able to recommend avoidance of breastfeeding under special conditions. UNAIDS and WHO and UNICEF have made certain recommendations. We can do that. But at the moment, we don't have the perfect plan for reducing mother-to-infant transmission. As I said, 076 has these logistic problems. There has the problems of breastfeeding. There are other biological factors. The factors that cause transmission between mother to infant might vary between developing and developed countries. And lastly, the cost of ACTG 076 is simply unaffordable in large parts of Africa. So for those reasons, that regimen was inapplicable to developing countries. There are a number of other alternatives. The UNAIDS study I spoke about is using not only AZT, but another drug called 3TC. And those results will be out soon, and so on and so forth. So I think in the space of about a year or two, developing countries, governments in developing countries, and protagonists for the reduction of mother-to-infant transmission will have a set of options before them, and they will have no excuse, to my mind, no excuse whatsoever for not choosing one of those options.
So the drug that you're talking about is a form of AZT?
It is AZT, yes. But it is AZT sometimes combined with another drug, and that's called 3TC. Those results are still not available, but will be available soon.
I imagine that many of the people who you see at the hospital are very poor, and that probably a good deal of them are uneducated. Would that be a fair assumption?
You're quite right. As I said before, the effects of apartheid persist today, and the public hospitals where people like me work are really hospitals which are frequented by the really poor, people who don't have medical insurance or don't have their own incomes to pay for private medicine. So inevitably, it is African children, and it is really the poorest of the African children. You know, in a phrase, it's really the poorest of the poor. So they have very, very little resources.
What kind of problems do you have trying to explain what AIDS is to the parents of the children who you treat, or to the children themselves if they're old enough to explain it to?
If you imagine that about 30% of women have got HIV, and that this has been around now for about 8, 9, 10 years, most African people know about HIV/AIDS. They understand it. And many of them have a fair idea of how it's transmitted. So that is not the problem. I think they understand it, and in fact, it strikes fear in their hearts. The problem is, how do you get over the other difficulties of them revealing this information and so on? I think that knowledge is not the problem.
What do you mean by revealing the information?
Well, they know how it's probably spread. They know the dangers of HIV, but it is not a socially acceptable disease in many, many instances. So it is not a neutral matter for a woman to go home and say to her husband, lover, or family that I have got HIV/AIDS. It creates a whole lot of problems with them at home, and there are instances where women are prejudiced, they're discriminated, they're abused, they're expelled, their affairs come to an end, marriages break, and so on. So they have to take that into consideration, and it ultimately depends on the individual woman. If she thinks she belongs in a family environment where she can share these secrets, it's not an obvious thing that she can. So we have to be very careful about advising her what to do about revealing her information.
Dr. Hussein Kuvadia is head of pediatrics at the University of Natal Medical School in South Africa and chair of the next International AIDS Conference. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. On this World AIDS Day, our guest is Dr. Hussein Kuvadia. He's the chair of the next International AIDS Conference, which will be held in the year 2000 in South Africa. He's also the head of pediatrics at the University of Natal in South Africa. His country has been very hard hit by the epidemic. About 40% of the children in his hospital have AIDS. Almost all of them got it from their mothers during labor or through breastfeeding. Now, how are most of the women who have AIDS in South Africa getting the disease?
They're getting it from men. Simple as that. Women, the studies that have been done here have shown that women are mostly monogamous, mostly. And therefore, they have only a minority of women, a small, small minority of women would have AIDS, HIV infection because of promiscuity. They get it from men because for many reasons, men have more sexual contact, and that sexual contact leads to to infection with this virus. Their sexual contact is often with commercial sex workers. It may be with other women who have casual sex, and therefore they are infected, the men are infected, and they come and come back home sometimes and infect the women. So it's in a way, it's the vulnerability of women which exposes them to the risk of HIV in South Africa and indeed in all of Africa. So it's the ultimate form of oppression of black women.
So if I'm hearing you right, that it's often a husband infects a wife, and then if the wife gets sick, she's expelled from the house for being sick, even though she got sick by contacting it through her husband.
Well, I'm not sure if it's such a straightforward linear relationship. What I'm saying is that's the usual way they get infected.
Mm-hmm.
It's usually from the men. The men have got, and we can discuss that a little later, but they are infected under their own circumstances. They pass it on to women. But generally speaking, because women depend on men for their livelihood, they are generally less educated, they have less opportunities for getting jobs, they therefore have less income. There are a whole lot of cultural pressures to keep them in their families, so they are entirely, often entirely dependent on men. And therefore, revealing an HIV status is quite a momentous business for a woman in that position. And when she's infected because she can't deny sex to a man who has such control and power over her. She can't insist on fidelity, in fact. She can't insist on knowing if he is exposing himself to other women who might be infected. She often doesn't have that power.
Well, how widespread is condom use in South Africa in the population that you treat, which is mostly poor people?
I can't give you accurate estimates because it's not. We don't have that sort of data. But as far as the government is concerned, there is a national AIDS program, like there are national AIDS programs in much of Africa. And they have distributed millions of condoms, and they are available free of charge. It's not to say they're easily accessible to men, but they are available. I don't have figures, but generally, the anecdotal accounts one has, which means the few odd small studies that have been done, suggest that condom use is not widespread.
I read that the South African government bought about 1.5 million female condoms. Do you know what the result of that was?
They did. They had some difficulties at the beginning because there were some problems about the usefulness of those. But they've just they started using them, and they've been testing their acceptability by women. And I understand they are acceptable by women, but I don't think there are any sufficiently rigorous impact studies to give you an information whether they are effective or not. But I think, you know, they're likely to be effective, but we need to wait a while to see how good they are.
Now, I know you've recently toured several other African countries. Just a few weeks ago, you toured Zambia, which is one of the countries most hard hit by the AIDS epidemic. Could you share with us some of what you saw there?
I think to look at the impact of AIDS in outside of the hospital, it gives you a good idea of the devastation it's causing in communities. And I think that's what Zambia taught me, at least. I was there for a different purpose, but what it showed when I looked around at the figures that Southern Africa is at the real epicenter of this epidemic globally. And about 70% of all the HIV cases in the world, there are about 30 million, 70% of them are in Africa, and most of them are in Southern Africa. So here we sit at the very raging vortex of this epidemic. And you see it in the figures, which indicate the regression in the development of human beings that we had been achieving in the past, say, 20, 30 years. So you see it in the fact that people live shorter lives, and not just 1 or 2 years, but on average, because of HIV/AIDS in the more severely hit countries like Zambia, by 16 years. So whereas they might have lived to, say, 66, they now would live at, sorry, they die at about 50. And Zambia, which I visited, has more people dying in that age group than who are dying of older age, that is, older than 50. It's a pattern which has virtually never happened in the history of infectious diseases amongst humans.
I recently read that although many people have been concerned about rising population rates in African countries, that because of the AIDS epidemic in Zimbabwe, the population is expected to start declining in about 4 years because the country has been so hard hit by AIDS. And that's a really almost shocking reversal in population trends.
I think so. That's true for some countries in Southern Africa. It hasn't happened yet.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly, you must remember that the people who we are seeing infected now were infected, let's say, 10 years ago. That's 1988. And the figures then in 1988 were nowhere like they were now. So if you imagine that roughly 1 in 4 adults in Southern Africa, 1 in 4 adults walking the streets, going to work, going to school, playing, etc. 1 in 4 is infected now. Can you imagine the horror of the death rates, etc., in the next 10 years when they will start dying? In a phrase, really, the worst is still yet to come.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Hussein Kuvadia, and he's the chairman of the next World AIDS Conference scheduled to be held in the summer of the year 2000. He's also the head of pediatrics and child health at the University of Natal Medical School in Durban, South Africa, where he says that about 40% of the children that he treats have AIDS. We'll take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Dr. Hussein Kuvadia. He's chairman of the next World AIDS Conference in the year 2000 and head of pediatrics and child health at the University of Natal Medical School in Durban, South Africa. Dr. Kuvadia, you're the chairman of the next World AIDS Conference, which will be held in the summer of the year 2000. What are some of the issues you would like to see addressed at that conference? And I believe it's going to be held in South Africa.
It's going to be held in Durban, actually.
Oh, okay.
And the reason we're rather pleased that it's coming here is that up to now, it's never been held in a developing country. And as I've indicated to you before, 70% of the problem is in developing countries. Sorry, in Africa. About 90% of the problem is in developing countries. So here we have a disease where 9 out of 10 cases are in amongst the poor nations of the world, and the conference is held in the rich countries of the world. It's a paradox which is obvious and which needed to be addressed. So that's why we applied. And we thought at least South Africa had, I think, the infrastructure and the facilities to hold the conference. That was important. And secondly, to hopefully refocus some of the priorities of the conference and to bring to the fore issues which are really important to poor black women in Africa, to women in Asia, and hopefully even women in China and Latin America, to talk about the difficulties of cultural constraints, about community responses, about family support, about the lack of availability of basic resources, the inability to get drugs, and so on and so forth, to refocus the issues for the people who matter most with this particular disease.
What are some of the other cultural issues that you'd like to raise at the conference?
There's another huge issue which affects the transmission of HIV in Africa, and that is the migration of people through international borders. Remember I said that men get infected. Why do men get infected in Africa and not in Europe and so on? It's because of the social dislocation of these migrations. UNAIDS, for example, in a draft document, has calculated, I think, that there's something like 38 million migrants, forced migrants, as people who didn't really want to leave and have left. So that's a huge population. And South Africa is par excellence an example of the devastating effects of such forced migrations on people. You remember our colonial history was such that men from neighboring countries came to work on our mines. And those mines still exist. And most of the men live in single-sex hostels. You can then imagine the destruction of family life, the casual sex, the casual attitudes to sex, the role of commercial sex workers to satisfy the sexual needs of these men who work in mines. That's going on every day. And that's exacerbating or maybe fundamental to the problem of the spread of HIV AIDS amongst black men in Southern Africa. So that's an issue which we really need to discuss. It's a problem which is not easily resolved because it goes to the heart of the economic infrastructure of many of our societies, but I think it must be addressed.
What is your best hope for reversing the AIDS epidemic in Africa?
At the end, I think a vaccine which works in African populations, which is not too costly, which is cheap, which can be delivered appropriately to people on the African continent, I guess that is going to be our salvation, if you wish, for people who are not infected. That is some years down the line, but in a way, when I look at the use of condoms, the treatment of sexually transmitted diseases, and so on, they do have an impact, and we, of course, must continue. But if you really want to make a major impact, I think a proper vaccine is going to be the answer. For children, of course, as you know, we can achieve wonders with antiretrovirals when they are properly and appropriately given.
How optimistic are you that we'll have a vaccine in a few years?
No, I'm not. I don't think it'll come in a few years. I think it'll. I have a sense it'll come, but it won't come under a decade. I don't think so. So we'll have to live with this problem. I don't think the rates of increase of HIV will continue. It's not sustainable that way. I think the at-risk populations get saturated and therefore the epidemic may level off. You'll get many more people dying, so the number of people with HIV, AIDS, will not necessarily increase at the rate it has been for the past 10 years. So I think we are in for a rough time for the next 10 years or so. But hopefully we won't make the mistakes of, or repeat the mistakes of the past in creating vaccines which become unavailable or inappropriate or don't work in populations in Africa and Asia and Latin America.
This is World AIDS Day, and one of the founders of World AIDS Day, Jonathan Mann, died a few months ago in a plane crash going to an AIDS-related conference in Geneva. I'm wondering how his death affected you and your work.
I didn't know him personally, but I knew about his work. And I think the things he stood for really mattered to me. I think he stood for the public health, the humane issues related to AIDS. And I think he devoted his life to that. I heard him speak on a number of occasions, and he reflects the sort of views that you've heard me expressing here. Not just the biological management of the problem, but the social, economic, humanitarian, cultural management of the problem. He had a vision of it, the control of HIV/AIDS, which is rather rare amongst people in the world of at his standing. And he was an extremely valuable individual in the fight against AIDS. I think we miss him because of that.
Well, Dr. Kuvadi, I wish you good luck with the planning of the World AIDS Conference in the year 2000. And thank you very much for spending some of this World AIDS Day with us and telling us about your work in South Africa.
Thanks very much.
Dr. Hussein Kuvadia is the head of pediatrics at the University of Natal Medical School in South Africa and chair of the next International AIDS Conference, which will be held in the year 2000.